or CJLO News, I'm Donald Roberge. As of May, the Société des Alcools du Québec, or SAQ, will be increasing its prices. While wines that cost $15 or less will not be affected, wines and spirits above that price limit will be moderately raised, with greater increases applying to more expensive products. The SAQ says that the adjustment is needed in order to compensate for rising operating costs. The Provincial Crown Corporation is also in the midst of negotiating with its suppliers, so is not in a position to be specific about its new prices, though they did say that the average bottle would be raised by 0.6%, whether it be for a $20 bottle of wine or a $45 bottle of spirits. The STM has announced that work has begun at the Atwater Metro Station in order to create elevator access for the public. The city's transit corporation says that the project will see two elevators installed by December, a benefit to those with mobility issues and with luggage, as well as for the young and the elderly. Two shafts had already been built between 2019 and 2021, when the station's waterproofing membrane was being replaced. With approximately 5.9 million boardings annually, the Atwater station is the sixth busiest in the metro network. It will also be the 11th station on the Green Line to have elevator access, with the STM hoping to have all 41 stations accessible by 2030. Montreal housing committees are busy educating renters on their rights. Katie Brady has more.
Good morning, Montreal. You're listening to The Get Up on CJLO 1690 AM with Lior Scherzer.
And Julia Israel. Welcome on the show today, guys. We have some fun things going on, more of an arts and culture week. Today we'll be talking to a local author who's releasing their new book coming up and a classical conductor. What's going on with the weather today, Leora?
It is currently -7 and snowy in Montreal, but feels like -13. We'll get up to a high of -2 this afternoon. The snow should stop later today and hold off until Sunday. Wind gusts up to 26 kilometers per hour today, so grab your jacket, gloves, hat, whatever you need to stay warm out there, and the sidewalks are a little slippery, so pay attention, but it's not so bad. It was one of those mornings where I didn't even have time to tie my shoes, and I still made it to the station.
Yeah, it's okay. The snow's fluffy, so hopefully the wind will blow it away, and we can go skating.
Oh, yeah. What's going on the roads?
Well, like every time it snows, we seem to forget that there's going to be snow on the road, so just be careful. It's going to be a little icy, well, not icy, just a little slippery. Otherwise, for traffic, we've got a little bit of a blockage eastbound on the 20 this morning and northward on the 15 by DeCary. But other than that, no major closures. We all seem to be good. So when we come back from the break, just a little short break, we're going to be speaking to Laure Marin de la Vallée on their new book, Autoimmune Heresy, which is launching later this month, so please stay tuned. Good morning. We're back.
Good morning.
We are back on CJLO, 1690 AM, The Get Up. Today we're speaking to Laure Marin de la Vallée about their new memoir entitled Autoimmune Heresy, which is a collection of writings of their personal history with chronic immune thrombocytopenia. I'm sorry about that. It's a chronic immune condition, and it's a difficult word, but we're going to get through it. Sorry. It's a story of perpetual healing. This book explores the issues of health and healthcare through disability justice lens, their experience of living with blindness and being trans, and the journey through living a sacred life amidst climate change and the cultural narratives that surround it. Welcome on our show, Laure.
Hi. Thank you, Julia. I'm such a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So first off, you were born and raised in Vancouver. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey that brought you to venture east to Montreal?
Yeah. So I was born out in Vancouver, but my mom is from the Gaspé Peninsula originally. So growing up, we kind of moved back and forth between the west and east side of the continent. I ended up in Montreal because I wanted to go study at Concordia, actually. I enrolled in film a few years ago, or I guess a decade ago now.
Very cool. Okay. So we have some things in common. I'm wondering about your writing process. This book is a memoir of 8 years of writing, you said, about your 20-year personal history with your chronic immune condition. And many deeply intertwined themes. Have you always been drawn to writing, or was it your practice of healing that brought you to it?
I've always been drawn to writing. I remember as a teenager, I guess I was drawn to reading first, and as I read voraciously, the practice of writing kind of emerged, but it crystallized as journaling for my own healing, kind of by virtue of doing it.
Okay, that sounds beautiful. Let's talk about the title. What does heresy mean to you in this sense, autoimmune heresy?
Yeah. Heresy is an important idea for me and an important practice for me because it is all about saying what it usually remains unsaid, or speaking counter to received knowledge, speaking counter to dominant knowledge. I chose the word heresy in order to honor the long history of heretics, people that spoke out against institutional authority and against the dominant narrative, and specifically the witches that were burned as heretics throughout the history of Europe.
Right. Thank you. Do you have an excerpt that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah. So as we had mentioned previously, I will be happy to share a brief excerpt. It's the manifesto, the autoimmune manifesto, that is one of the linchpins of the book.
That would be great.
Okay. One, the transience of the body itself is holy. Two, autoimmunity is self-defense, multifarious resistance, radical permeability, touchability. Three, autoimmunity demands surrender, re-evaluation of what makes you human, what makes you, you. Four, there is no such thing as health. Five, autoimmunity shatters the telos upon shores of blood. Treatment of symptoms agonizes the root cause. Six, autoimmunity is not an illness. It is endowment with strength, power, knowledge. Seven, autoimmunity is self-knowledge, a map, responsibility. Eight, through autoimmunity, universal entanglements reverberate in felt sense. Nine, autoimmunity is not a curse. It is the wise wound within the body. 10. I would rather be sick and cunning than healthy and dull. 11. If I am sick, the land is sick. 12. Autoimmunity is the body in revolt against global poisoning. 13. Autoimmunity transcends identity. 14. Culture is autoimmune. 15. Autoimmunity diffracts the body's holistic contacts. 16. You can be autoimmune without conscious acceptance. Soon enough, your body will tell you. 17. Autoimmunity is a form of mourning, the body grieving worldly cruelty. 18. Autoimmunity is a call to listen. 19. It is inexorable change. 20. It is embodied heresy. 21. It is both constructive and destructive interference. 22. Autoimmunity is necessarily solitary, but you are not alone.
Thank you for that, Laure. With 20 years since your diagnosis, you share your personal experiences with the medical field and professionals. You say at times you felt as a human in the system and as a patient, you feel both blindfolded and the donkey. And this really stood out to me when I was reading your book. I think this speaks to agency, to a certain accountability or even punishment that patients feel. Can you explain this feeling or the fallacy of health a bit more?
Yeah. My experience as a patient was that I was expected to not ask questions. I was sort of as a person, I was not in a position to make decisions about myself. And when I was a child, this seemed natural to me. It seemed normal. There was a point in my early 20s where it started to seem wrong that I should not have this capacity for self-governance, self-actualization, self-realization, self-sovereignty. This idea, this metaphor of being both blindfolded and the donkey itself, is that especially in a context of autoimmunity where a diagnosis is either applied a long time ago and then people behave as if it's real forever, or if there's no diagnosis at all, then a doctor is not operating with full knowledge of what is going on. A doctor, most doctors, will posture as if they know what is going on. But they are playing a game of pin the tail on the donkey with patients. The needles, the drugs, the procedures, they're all just like attempts to win a game. And that's not the most generous take on medicine, but it feels like it is a common experience amidst people who are chronically dealing with the medical system.
Right. You reflect a lot about climate change, about the sickness of the land, about your body's connection to the land. When did you first feel this connection between your body and the land, and how has that developed or changed over time?
Mm-hmm. I first felt it when I was an infant or a toddler. Like you said, I was born in Vancouver. I grew up there largely. And both before and after my diagnosis, I got to be in the forest a lot, listen to the rivers a lot, just play and be totally at ease in that environment. What happened is that then there were many, many years where those experiences were unavailable to me. I was away from the West Coast. I was living in cities. And it came back in a full force kind of way during the pandemic. In the first year of pandemic, I moved away from Montreal and I moved to the Gaspé Peninsula, which is where my mother's from. And there, living alone, doing a lot of research and walking a lot along the St. Lawrence in the forest, it anchored that it is by connecting back to the living earth and by connecting to my own very complex ancestral history here and elsewhere that any healing becomes possible. It feels like connection to place and to the present moment on earth is a prerequisite for me to understand the situation of my own body. Like I said in the manifesto, if the land is sick, I am sick. There's a lot to be felt with the sort of relationship between the toxicity of the dirt itself and the toxicity that runs through my veins.
I hear that. You also talk about in your manifesto that autoimmunity transcends identity. What does that mean for you in your experience? Because I think that's something that a lot of us can relate to. You also mention like culture is autoimmune. And I think that there's just something really transcendent in that I think mm-hmm. is very relatable.
Yeah. When I say that it transcends identity, I mean that anyone can be thrown into the whirlwind that is autoimmunity. There is a differential sort of risk for people who are more or less susceptible to environmental factors, but the fact of the body disharmonizing and dysregulating and so-called turning against itself happens no matter what one's position at birth is, no matter what one's various orientations are, no matter whether they feel that the culture they were born into represents them adequately or not. Somebody who feels totally at home in their place of birth could develop autoimmunity just as much as someone who is rootless and displaced. And that's the identity piece. Culture feels autoimmune because culture is turned against itself. There are a variety of dichotomies that are apparent to me and a variety of paradoxes that are apparent to me in culture that make it feel as though the immune system metaphor for culture is really apt in this moment. In this moment where sickness has taken center stage, illness has taken center stage as a key factor for how all of the environments I've found myself in, anyway, navigate the world. So if I am to navigate the culture that I live in, I must also learn to navigate my body's porousness.
Mm-hmm. You also talk a lot about in your book, this is my last question, because I wish we can talk forever, but we don't have too much time. But on being well and being productive, you speak a lot about the operational value that our bodies have in this system, in a capitalist system. How have you made space for your own body, and how can we all in a system like this, on a maybe lighter note?
I've made space by being uncompromising in a lot of ways. I believe that it is of utmost importance to listen to one's own needs, to learn what they are. I took the chances that I had to step away from the imperative to be productive, to not go to grad school, to not get a full-time job, to just really, really rest for as long as I could. And that involved a lot of learning and research about nutrition, for example, and about embodiment practices, somatics, martial arts. My main practices these days are kung fu, contact improvisation dance. I cook for myself extensively. And these are things that have gotten me into a state of total remission that is now 2 years along. You know, the book is about the period of sickness, but the reality of life is that by sowing those seeds in my early 20s, now that I'm turning 28, I have a state of, or a relationship with my body that is joyful and always in a growth zone.
That's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing with us. I want to shout out your book launch. It's February 23rd at 6 p.m. at 266 Rue Saint-Viateur West. Is the book available now or it will be launching then?
So the book will be available online on February 21st. If anybody wants to stay updated, they can go to my website, which is www.lore.love. That's LAURE.LOVE. Sign up, get an email as soon as it's available, after February 21st, walk into your local independent bookstore and ask for it.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Laure Marin de la Vallée, on your book, Autoimmune Heresy. This is such a beautifully poetic book, and I want everybody to read it, so go find it. Thank you for talking with us today, Laure.
Thank you, Julia. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a quick music break. You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM, The Get Up, with Laure Scherzer and Julia Israel. After the break, we will be speaking with classical conductor Daniel Bartholomew Poyser. Stay tuned.
Dive into the ultimate. Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Brew. Crossover Comics. Sharing your passion since 2012.
You were listening to L'Indifférent by Maurice Ravel. Before that, we heard The Swan, the theremin cover by Claire Rockmore, one of the most iconic theremin players of all time. On the get-up this morning, we have Daniel Bartholomew Poyser. He's the first openly gay black orchestra conductor in Canada. He's also a composer, teacher, and radio host of CBC's Center Stage. Daniel's made headlines for putting a spin on classical music orchestra performance, from bringing a quartet to a women's prison to organizing a drag symphony with Queen Thorgy Thor. Tomorrow he will be performing with the Obior Ensemble here in Montreal. Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, it's great being here with you.
I guess bringing it back in time, can you talk a little bit about your journey into classical music? What drew you to become a conductor?
Well, I started off playing piano. I was put in piano lessons dutifully by my mom when I was a kid. And then when I was in junior high school, I was introduced to band, right? And that was probably the introduction to ensemble playing music. I had access to an instrument. I was given an instrument, you know, I think it was like $30 a month or something like that. And I had a tuba. And I just loved playing in band. And then from there, I guess I just didn't stop playing in large ensembles up to, you know, rehearsal in half an hour. I just kept on going because I had access to instruments and I had access to music, and there were no really barriers in that way put in front of me. So I just loved it. Conducting, I think, is it blends a lot of like nerdy research stuff with a lot of performance. I think that's what I really enjoy about it. A lot of time spent studying, a lot of time spent with people. And those two sides of the coin are really fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was wondering, because, yeah, you hear lots of people, I guess, getting into the classical music world, but you don't meet too many conductors.
That's true. There's usually only one conductor in a city at a time, unless it's like the Montreal area where there's so many wonderful orchestras, and then there'll be, you know, more of us. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, conducting, you know, one orchestra might have 100 players, but there's only one conductor ultimately, so there aren't that many of us. We're like ships passing in the night.
Good to know. I guess, how did you get the idea to bring a live classical quartet to a prison, and maybe talk a little bit about why it's important to bring classical music to groups that would not normally get to experience it?
Well, in terms of the prison, I think I'd ask the question, why not? Like, why aren't more people doing that? I think that's the question. Why aren't more people taking their music to places? Yeah, I'd turn the question around. Why aren't more people taking their music to places that are different or to people who can't come to them?
Totally.
That's the question I would ask in response to that. Mm-hmm. I think, why prison? Really, why not? It just seemed kind of self-evident. When I was teaching, I worked for the John Howard Society, which is a society that's based on aiming reducing recidivism for prisoners, which means like helping them once they get out of jail not to go back to jail because they don't have the structural supports in their lives often that many of us are privileged to have. So I worked in that sort of environment when I was a teacher. So it was pretty natural for me to think, well, why don't we just do an orchestra in a prison and have music for the prisoners? Because maybe when they come out, they'd like to come to the symphony, right? That's not really a big deal. And I think like all these other places that I'm doing music, it's just not sequestering other parts of my life off from my career, right? So when I was in university, I had friends who worked with neurodivergent people, and I thought, well, hey, why don't we have a concert for them? Why don't we work with them? Absolutely. It totally makes sense. And then, you know, being a person of color, my Trinidad and Jamaican roots, I don't sequester that off from my career in music. It's not like Bach, Beethoven are separate for me necessarily from reggae and Beyonce. We can have them all in one concert if we're doing, you know, music about singing or music about dancing. So, you know, it's just about not really acknowledging barriers and not feeling them. And this is partly because of the way that I was brought up and partly because of, you know, access that I had to music as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And your classical performances often have a twist or something different, like the drag orchestra with Thorgy, or you've got an upcoming Bhangra and classical symphony fusion. I feel like in our culture, classical music is something very specific and very traditional. Why is it important for you to change that?
Right. I don't actually know if I'd agree. I think that's the perception, that we are traditional and stodgy. And I would say like 40% of the stuff that we do is traditional. Mm-hmm. And then the other 60%, it's like, look at any orchestra roster and they're doing, you know, Star Wars with, right, with film, Home Alone. They're doing all this different stuff. Cirque du Soleil with orchestra. Yeah. So part of what I'm doing, I think, that might be a little bit different is, you know, having a, like Bhangra music with orchestra. Okay, that's different. Reggae with orchestra, that's different. But if you, we're all working really hard in the industry right now to, and it's not just me, to really have interesting, innovative programs that will change the way people are coming to the symphony or meeting orchestral music. That's really important to all of us across industry, across North America right now. So yeah, I think that it is changing, and I would challenge people to look at their local orchestra, like wherever they are, and see what's on the roster for the entire year. And you will see diversity there. You will see different sorts of programs. You will be surprised. You will be surprised. And yeah, some of the work I'm doing is hopefully surprising as well too. But all of us are on the same page across Canada and North America. Yeah.
Yeah, you're totally right. Last summer I actually went to the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra's production of Ratatouille. It was like they were playing Ratatouille over, or they were playing their live symphony over the Ratatouille movie screening in the background, which was
exactly.
Awesome. So you'd say classical music culture is kind of changing more broadly.
Yes, I would say so. Yeah, we're just incorporating more things. We're just incorporating much more than we ever have before.
I guess. Are there any other inspiring classical music performers that you think are putting a spin? I know you're saying this is like a broader shift that's happening, but yeah, who else is putting like queer classical music on the map that you know of?
Edwin Oatwater is the previous conductor of the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony that existed in Ontario. And, you know, that symphony orchestra, they lost. It's interesting. If we love orchestral music, and we love music, and we love having all these musicians in our community that do just not only symphony music, but also so many different types of music and enrich the community through education and programs for young people and some of the stuff that I'm doing, we really have to support them. After the pandemic, the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony lost the majority of its subscription subscribers, and that made it incredibly hard for that orchestra to continue. Anyways, they're no longer with us, but the music director, Edwin Oatwater, is one of my mentors and one of my really great inspirations. He's in San Francisco, he's all over the world, BBC proms, all over North America, conducting these incredible concerts. He was the first conductor to do a drag concert. I was the first in Canada, but he's the first conductor in the world that I know of to do a drag concert with orchestra, and his programs are just phenomenal. So Edwin Oatwater is somebody that I really look up to in the industry that's creating really incredible programs. For example, S&M with Metallica and the San Francisco Symphony, he was the conductor for that.
Very cool.
So, yeah, there are lots of us that are doing our best to do innovative, captivating work.
And you're speaking of queer conductors, composers. In your talk last night, you were kind of alluding to, I guess, theories of classical composers where like people theorize that they were queer. Would you say there's kind of a relationship between queerness and like classical symphony music? I guess I'm also thinking of Tar, that was kind of bringing queer classical music on the map.
Right. I haven't seen Tar yet.
What?
Yeah, I know. I haven't seen Tar yet because everybody tells me that it's really realistic, and I feel like I work all day and I just want to watch a horror movie at night.
Yeah, fair. Like something, oh my God. Like, that's so funny.
Predictable and where I feel in control. So I haven't watched Tar yet.
That's hilarious.
I don't know that, you know, it's funny. I wouldn't be able to establish a relationship between queerness and orchestral music necessarily. There have been many really inspiring queer performers. Leonard Bernstein, his movie Maestro came out. He was a queer performer. He had many different varieties of relationship throughout his life. So I think that those of us who are in the industry and who have been in historical industry, definitely we see queerness popping up through composers, through producers, through dancers, actors. It's a place where queerness has been, I think, more accepted than other places in society.
Totally.
So it has been a safer place, perhaps, than others, for sure, for those of us who are part of the Twist LGBTQIA+ community.
Awesome. You mentioned in your presentation last night that in the orchestra world, you're often the only Black person in the room, and that there are a lot of stereotypes of what genres Black musicians are kind of confined to. Can you talk a bit about the impact of that experience on your work?
Sure. I've always usually been the only Black person in the room, and sometimes if there are Black people in the audience, it's because they're people that I invited. You know, it's like my mom is there. So it's been really nice with Ensemble Viera to be able to perform with other people who have had a similar experience, right? And Ensemble Viera is not all, you know, it's everybody. They're de Québécois. There are, you know, people of Asian descent. Everybody is part of the ensemble, and that's part of the celebration, the joy of it. So in terms of informing our work, being the only Black person in the room, it's been nice to perform music like the reggae concert that I had with the National Arts Center Orchestra, to have, you know, people from the reggae community come out and enjoy the music. And we're hoping that when the Toronto Symphony Orchestra takes the Bhangra concert to Brampton, which has a really wonderful, vibrant Indian community, that we'll be supported there, and that we'll be performing that, well, not that we'll be supported, but we'll be supporting them. Right, but performing music that community knows and loves, and I've tried to do my best research to find out like what are the big hit songs that everyone's going to love in Bhangra music, and hopefully when we play them, people will go, you know, the crowd will go wild. That's what we're hoping for.
Awesome.
Right, so I'd say that's that experience of being the only Black person in the room, which has not always been negative. I would say I'm just kind of used to it,
right,
and hasn't been negative. Right, that has helped me just appreciate. Still, when I'm not the only Black person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it doesn't make an appreciable, like, once you get to, you know, making the actual music, I don't know that it makes an appreciable difference, right? It's like, say I was the first, you know, Black pilot for Air Canada, right? Okay, well, when the airplane's, you know, 30 meters off the runway at the airport, you know, it doesn't, the race isn't an issue. It's like, can you land the plane? Can you do the job? Right? So we're all here together, but then afterwards it's a celebration, this feeling, okay, we're doing something here. So Ensemble Viera, we're doing something that's different, that's special. Right? And when you come and hear the music, you'll be like, oh yeah, this is high quality. It's a high quality ensemble, right? The players are top notch.
Mm-hmm.
So when you come and hear the music, you'll be like, oh wow, this is serious music making.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then there's this other added element of the fact that, you know, they're trying to do something new, and they are doing something new and beautiful and wonderful for the community, for bringing people together in a different way and highlighting some of the some of the new ways in which we can come together.
For sure. And you grew up as a Christian queer kid in Alberta. You touched on this a little bit last night, but what role does spirituality play in your art today?
Well, you know, I, that's probably the subject for another documentary. it's a fairly intense question.
Yeah, for sure.
And also, like, I'm kind of a private, like, person. So the spirituality part of it is, you know, it's, especially having come through such a ringer with it, coming from a spiritual background that was not inclusive of to us LGBTQIA+, and then to transition out of it, it's kind of like, it's almost like talking about a divorce a little bit,
mm-hmm.
right? And people always ask, well, what was it like? It's like, it's really hard to discuss.
For sure.
And it's something that takes years and years to kind of reckon with, I think. So I would say that like, spirituality versus religion in my life, it's popular to talk about spirituality, but not religion. But I was more like of a religious person.
Yes.
It's like, you know, tell me the prayers to say, tell me the time to do it, and I will like do it. I'm more regimented and structured rather than just like, you know,
yeah.
You know, prayers going up all times of day and stuff like that. I've definitely kept some of it, and I think it's still very important to me. But in terms of like the actual structure, like the content is there, but the actual structure, sorry, the form.
Mm-hmm.
The content is still there, but the form in which it takes has changed dramatically and necessarily, right? In order to accommodate the reality of myself as a queer person, right? That's what I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been some morphing, there's been some fighting, some war and turmoil. But I mean, when you read spiritual letters of, you know, the great spiritual masters from different traditions, there is always this sort of a battle. Right. When it comes to spirituality and integration to one's life. So in terms of my career in music and stuff like that, I don't know, ask me in another 10 years.
Yes.
And then I'll be able to know. But yeah, I hope that answers some of it. It's not
Absolutely.
A clear answer because it's not a really clear situation, I
of
guess.
Course.
Yeah.
No, thank you so much for that. And we're going to wrap up pretty soon here, but yeah, maybe talk about your show tomorrow and the Ensemble au Bureau and what, sure. what you've got planned.
Sure. Well, the show is about influences, and we have music that comes from different influences. First of all, we have like Argentinian tangos, right, by Brigado and Piazzolla, and that's the influence of the dance on the music and the dance on the composer. You know, the Piazzolla loved the tango, and he actually got in trouble for mixing the tango with orchestral Western music and Western instruments. People thought that he shouldn't do that. They were purists. They said, you can't do tango with the orchestra. That's wrong. And they didn't say in quite those words. They were much more violent and vehement about it. And now he's one of the greats, right? So his fusion of tango and orchestra proved immensely successful. The influence of tango on his music is indelible. Then we have Dinuk Gujaratne, who's a Sri Lankan Canadian-born composer. And he is, his piece is called Polyphonic Lively. And he takes, in a very, very imaginative and inventive way, just the sounds of his music, the sounds of, I didn't want to say the sounds of Sri Lanka, because you wouldn't necessarily know if I wasn't telling you, right? You'd just be like, wow, this is an incredibly vibrant, evocative piece. He takes that and puts that into his music. So he's influenced by his culture, and he takes that to heart. And you hear it in this incredible sounds of Polyphonic Lively. And then we have Elgar's Enigma Variations, which is about the influences of essentially love, I would say, but not this close to Valentine's Day, a romantic love at the fore, but the love of friendship, which is not often a love that is celebrated as much as, you know, running through the fields with the big I love you. This piece is about his friends and the people that supported him. And there's a particular movement, Nimrod, which everybody loves, the slow movement, which has been performed so many times because it's so gorgeous. That is about a friend who supported him during a very, very rough time in his life. So the influences of his friends led to the creation of this piece, and we're so thrilled that we'll round out the program called Influences.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Daniel, for coming on the show. It's been such a joy talking to you, and I'm really glad to have learned about your work. Yeah, you're really doing amazing stuff out there.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be part of the show today.
That was classical conductor Daniel Bartholomew Poyser. He will be performing with the OBR Ensemble tomorrow evening at Salle Pierre Mercure Hall.
Awesome. We're going to take a little bit of a music break and an ad break. Coming up after the ad will be Recomposed by Max Richter.
Hydro-Québec cherche du monde pour travailler cet été comme guide dans ses centrales et centres d'interprétation partout au Québec. Du monde qui a envie de faire partie d'une équipe énergique qui contribue à changer le monde. Du monde qui souhaite vivre une expérience inoubliable qui ouvre des portes. Tu aimes t'exprimer en public et tu cherches un emploi bien rémunéré? Joins-toi à l'équipe. Postule d'ici le 3 mars au hydroquebec.com/emploi-guide.
You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM, The Get Up with Lior Schertzer and Julia Israel. It is 9:52 AM. We are wrapping up our show this morning. If you have any thoughts, if you want to say hi, you're welcome to give us a call. I forget what our number is.
The number is 51. Write this down. The number is 514-848-7471. Please just call us.
But if you're feeling shy, you could also shoot us a DM on our Instagram, thegetup.mtl. I know it can be intimidating to get live on the air, but we are happy to receive feedback, messages, whatever you want to say. If you missed our interviews today, you can catch them on the archive on cjlo.com or the SoundCloud for CJLO, the Get Up playlist. You could also find our interviews on Spotify.
Yeah. And you should follow us on Instagram at thegetup.mtl. You can find all those links there.
Get a little updates, get a little sneak preview every week.
Exactly. Lior, how's the weather looking? Is it still snowing outside?
That's a really good question. Let me look out the window. It's snowing a little bit. It's snowing. It is -5 now. The weather app says that it's not snowing, but that's not the reality outside. I don't know how to reconcile that.
Sometimes you gotta trust your gut.
Sometimes
or
you gotta
your
trust
vision.
Your eyes. -5 Montreal, high of -2, low of -7. Wind gusts up to 15 miles per hour. I was saying kilometers earlier. It was 26, I think, kilometers per hour. That's all I got on the weather. But thanks for tuning in to The Get Up on CJLO 1690 AM. We're going to play out some music for the rest of the hour.
Yeah, up next we have Sage and Shade by Dynasty. We'll catch you next week.
No one sounding like me. Bitch, I got the pinky up with my T. And I look all envious, you might be. So politely, don't fuck with my chi. Got them on the block and chat maneuver. Because I attract like I'm the new girl. They were right, believe what you heard. Bitch, this wave will fuck up your her. Ha! I don't need a new purse. Bitch, I need skills that raise the net worth. I need a team that put in that work. I got a dream like I was Luther. I gotta flip the checks that I get. Phone back home, the funds have been sent. I'm all in, I'll take the expense. Give me that mortgage over that rent. Ha!
Ha. Like that.
Shake.
Get that.
Sway.
Sway.
In a dip, I'ma focus on the chips, getting it. Honey, if you feel neglect, here's a tip. Go and get another friend, common sense. I am on a mission here, so my dear, no bitching in my ear, stay clear. I don't need those flashing lights in my rear. Focused on driving, facing my fears. You up, you get it. Have you ever lived a life with no credit? Stop with all the idiot arguments, dead it. Over turf that all of you renting, that's how you flexing. What? I don't got time. I just took a sip of my wine. Need to unwind. Heard a cop just killed a black man. Then a black man turned around and killed a black man. What? Did I tap in? Can I tap out? This is killing me.
Killing me.
Sometimes I can't even fucking breathe. Is it okay? Cause we've got some weed. And melodies, is that all you need?
Say
like that.
And shake.
Get that.
Sway.
Sway.
מסתי דואג נפסי
דואג
יא
איפה לי שבקע שם עזפי
רפאי רגלי פוי שכל חקוד חקוד
Wow. مفيش شبهي في بلدك قارن ورقي بورقك بلدك المفضلة بنما دنيا ومليش عزيز مرقة وانا كالماريو جيت اشعلل جيت اكسرك وجيت اكعبل قالولي ايه الغرض ليه مستعجل ساحب الكاش حماس دفعت البين سبورت انا رياضي مان لابس الشورت انا موسيقى انا اللي عازف الكورد حلقت لها عشان انا اللورد very important اتنين نوم عايز فيون ديف تيجي نيو جيز على طول تاخد روم كيز قول تشيز خدني صورة باخد تور فيه لما تعوز فيه تخلي بالك انا اقوم بيك بطل عالم داخل مول اجيب كاب حصل حالة بيجيب سيرتي كتير واخد بالك انا مش مشغول بي واخد بالك ايه واول ما تسقف انا رقصة كل ما تعقد عقد عقد انا بسطة هتروح تجيب اجلي باشا قصط وكل ما تعقد عقد عقد انا بسطة
في اوبشن ان انا اتكلم في الحته دي
اتكلم
عملتها
جامده
ايه دوري مي فا سولا سي دو ده قبل ديا ودي قبل دول ذكاء مالو حدود يا مان افلاطون انت روحت في الرجلين بنطلون على كيفك خد هت يا باشا على عينك اي 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 مكارينا اصحابي كذا بلانكا اصحابك كذا هيتا
كابتن طلب صغير ابلع ريقك خد بق ميا بطلت هايبر ياسطا شكلك كده مش مسيطر
حبيبي على بالي كتير جميل بني غامق صافي زي الحرير البنت افتكرتني في كايروكي اصل تصرفاتي زي الامير مش عايزة اتمنظر بس ده بصراحة مش منظر باشا يخشن انا اجيبه يتصنفر باشا يتلم انا اشيله يتكمر
واول ما تسقف انا رقصة ما تعقد عقد عقد انا بسطة هتروح تجيب اجلي باشا قصطة وكل ما تعقد عقد عقد انا بسطة
كسر الوزة ببسي حاجز الليستة باسمي مارومان لسه بتجري مجالك مستحلف لي لكن التسلا في جهتي
حلو هلا
جهتي معادي it's just المعادي it's just جهتي فهم وادي
يس
22
27
بومين
29
My name is